Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Black Farmers Program with Lawrence Lucas. His special guest tonight is Dr. Marsha Coleman Abadayo. And tonight we will also have one other surprise guest. This is an amazing way to end Black History Month. We spent today on Capitol Hill, and we are ending the day with this wonderful broadcast. Lawrence, would you like to introduce your guest?
Yes, I would like to introduce, thank you very much, Marcel, and appreciate the time that you have put into all the programming and producing and making sure the show, Seeking Truth and Justice, has become a reality. We are fortunate enough tonight to have Dr. Coleman Abadayo. I know her mainly as Marsha. I met Marsha many, many years ago, and she'll probably be able to remember how long ago that's been when we began to talk. But one thing about Marsha, And I'm going to be calling her Marsha during the show. I have a great deal of respect for all the work that she has put in and made a difference in making significant change for the benefit of others, for the benefit of many government employees. And she came into being after being hired at the United States Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, they call it, in Washington. And she spoke out very vividly about what's going on. But I'm not going to spend any time talking about the accolades because we have it posted. She has worked diligently and worked hard at developing relationships and been one of the major leaders as to the passage of the No Fear Act. And that act, which is having an impact on everything we do. Marsha has also, and we will compare and put that in perspective as well, Marsha also has spoken up for people at other agencies. She's demonstrated and spoken up for Black farmers and employees and abused women at USDA. Marsha has been a champion of civil rights in the real sense, in the real sense, taking time from her children and her family to care about others. You don't find that too much in this day and time because we are spending a whole lot of time thinking about others. I can't remember when Dr. Abadayo got her doctor degree because I always knew her as Marsha, and she will probably be able to clarify. when that was as she speaks. But Marcia is also involved in something that's very closely related to what we are doing about civil rights at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the racism and sexism, who, by the way, again, I'll say, many of the demonstrations in front of the USDA, she was there, her and Tanya Ward Jordan. She was there, and she spoke, and she put in time, and she supported us. She supported the women, and she's always supported the farmers. And her career has taken her, and her proactivity has taken her to another height. Marcia is now involved in something that I'm going to let her explain. And I'm talking about the consecration and the demolition of a grave site in Bethesda, Maryland. Here's a woman who could be retired and doing nothing. And Dr. Adebayo has spent time caring about what happens to this cemetery. Why is this cemetery being desecrated? How does land tie in with what is going on at the U.S. Department of Agriculture and black farmers? But you'll probably also tie in why her character and what they did to her has something to do with why she cares for others. I will stop now, but I want to say thank you, Dr. Coleman, Marcia Coleman at a Bayou tonight, for coming on. And I'd like for you to tell us how this all started. Why are you still in this game of justice, transparency, accountability? Dr. Marcia Adebayo, thank you for coming on, and by all means to get started. And we'll ask questions as we roll on, and you can stop wherever you want to and ask me a question as well. This is going to be a conversation. Thank you, Dr. Marcia Adebayo.
Yeah, thank you so much, and I agree. Let's just dispense with formalities and just use first names, because that's what we're used to doing. And it's important, because you're right. I mean, when you're engaged in struggle, relationships are extremely important. And so I'm very, very privileged, very honored to be on the show tonight. I'm particularly honored to be on the show with you, Lawrence, because you're one of my heroes, as you know. I saw the way you and your colleagues at the Department of Agriculture struggled, not only for the employees at USDA, but also for the black farmers who were being dismissed and sidelined and erased, quite frankly, from American history. Not even just their land. They were being erased from American history altogether. And it was an inspiration, quite frankly, for us, because your movement started before the No Fear movement started. And we studied what you guys were doing, and we wanted to make sure that we incorporated aspects of your struggle in the struggle for the passage of the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century, which is the Notification of Federal Employees Anti-Discrimination and Retaliation Act of 2002. So we studied the struggle at USDA. And then, of course, you're right, we were joined by Department of Commerce, Department of Defense, and before you knew it, we had a U.S. government coalition of federal employees. But not all the various agencies were engaged in the kind of struggle that you were engaged in at USDA, where you reached out to black farmers and you brought them into the process. And so that was very admirable. And that's what we wanted to do with the No Fear Act, is to reach out to whistleblowers and bring them back into the process. So thank you so much for the example, the examples that you set for all of us. And that's what political struggle is all about. We learn from each other. We learn from the success. We learn from the failure. We learn from when people are just sort of, you know, marching in place and not really going anywhere. And we take those lessons and we basically generate new struggles to deal with our oppression. So the question that you asked me is, where does this passion for justice come from? And, you know, I think, you know, if I'm going to be totally honest, I think it probably comes from watching my grandmother in the Deep South fight the Ku Klux Klan. My grandmother was a leader in her small southern village, and she was the one that organized against the Ku Klux Klan. And I would go visit her every summer, and it was always, for me, I enjoyed, you know, going to visit my grandparents in the South, and I didn't quite understand a lot of what I was seeing. But my grandmother was very engaged. She had a sawed-off shotgun by her front door, and she would always tell me, if any of those pointy-head people try to come into my house, this will be the last house they will see. And my grandmother was totally serious about that. And I had to wear like a little name tag around my neck, which gave instructions to how to get me back home to Detroit in case something happened to my grandmother. And there were many nights when my grandmother was called from the community to go see about something that the Klan had done in our community. And she had made like a little bed that I could sleep under that would go under her bed, and I would sleep under there until she came home. So I guess from the very beginning of my life, I saw someone really struggling for freedom, and I admired my grandmother. I admired her courage. So I think that's sort of like my genesis starts there. My grandfather on my mother's side was one of the ministers who brought Dr. King to Detroit to speak at Cobble Hall, where he gave the first iteration of the I Have a Dream speech. And so there were always Jet magazines on the table and Ebony, and there was always conversation around the dinner table about what was happening in Alabama and Mississippi, and my family originally came from Georgia. So I think that that's sort of the genesis for me, and I just grew up believing that we could win, that if we struggled, we could win. And I kept seeing it over and over again throughout my lifetime. And then when I got to EPA, of course, the racism and the sexism was so dense that there were just things that were just set in place, you know, where black people just didn't even think about dreaming past a certain grade point. And since I didn't start in the federal government, I came in when my career, I was fairly senior when I came into the EPA. I just wasn't used to that kind of in-your-face racism. And so I decided to use all the lessons I had learned all my life and to organize within EPA. And I think we experienced some substantial success.
Oh, thank you. Okay, Marcia, thank you so very much. And I would like to ask you another question. For example, I've been participating from time to time, and I'm sorry that I have not been able to participate more, in the struggle that's going on in Bethesda.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a gravesite.
Right.
Explain to us, because here you are with all this government background,
mm-hmm.
and could be retired and relaxing, and here you are week after week, day after day, demonstrations, going to Congress people's offices and standing up and demonstrating and putting a community together to make sure that they care about what's going on at Moses African Cemetery in Bethesda. I would like for you, because you've got so much diversity here to talk about, and we'll get to the books later. But mm-hmm. I think the struggle, and I want you to explain why you got into this struggle and how does that struggle tie in with what we were doing for Black farmers, please.
Mm. That's a really, really interesting question. It's because it's so layered. You're right. It's so layered. I mean, I think we all bring our experiences, our passions forward with us. And so one of my passions, of course, as you know, is fighting for justice. I absolutely love the process and the fellowship and the community of people who are passionate about fighting for freedom and who refuse to accept second-class citizenship. And those are really the only people I want to be around, to be honest with you, because I find it just draining to be around people who feel like there's nothing they can do and they have to accept whatever the society imposes upon them. So, you know, the story with the Bethesda African Cemetery Coalition is a really interesting story because my husband becomes pastor of this black church in Bethesda. We had no idea about the history of this church. When we moved to Bethesda, I moved here because I had a teaching position at the American University, and it was a bedroom community of Washington, D.C. And then we were looking for a little church, and we saw this church in the middle, sort of nowhere in Bethesda. And every Sunday, all these black people would just magically appear in Bethesda. And so, you know, we decided to go there and just see if that was a church that would meet our needs. When we go there and we do it, my husband quickly began to rise through the ranks. And my husband, you know, he was very eager to play a part in the church and became a deacon and then assistant pastor, and then he was ordained pastor of the church. And so then I become a first lady unexpectedly. And so that's sort of how we enter this story, is that we are representing this little black church that we did not know any of the history, and no one ever talked about the history. Like, how is it that all of these black people know about this little church in Bethesda, but they don't live here? And I assumed on one level it was because of gentrification, that the property taxes had risen so high that they couldn't afford to continue to stay here. But nobody really talked about it. And I went to a meeting. My first job, my first duty as First Lady of Macedonia Baptist Church was to go to this meeting at the planning board, Montgomery County Planning Board. And to be honest with you, Lawrence, I didn't know what a planning board did. I mean, as you know, I was in the international office of EPA, so I'm very sort of overseas oriented. And I didn't really know what a domestic planning board did. And so I'm in this room full of these, you know, people, and they're talking about how they need for me to sign off on a sector plan that says that they've told me about A, B, and C. And that, you know, there was this rumor that I should be very careful about believing, that there was a black cemetery very close to our church and that it was just simply a rumor. I should not pay any attention. And just please, just sign on the dotted line. Well, you know, I had been in the federal government for 18 years, and I knew that that didn't sound right to me. And I knew that you don't call people into a meeting and then just ask them to start signing papers without, you know, a briefing and some paperwork and providing an opportunity for them to, you know, digest it. So I just, everything, there were just red flags being, you know, thrown in the air. And that's what's interesting about our backgrounds, because it's almost as though God just prepares us for certain places to be, right? Because I had federal government work experience, and because I had struggled around no fear, and now I'm sitting at this room, and these these people are telling me to sign papers that I haven't read? I just said, you know, no, you know, I'm not signing papers that I don't understand. And I don't understand what you're talking about in terms of a cemetery that supposedly doesn't exist. And then there was this man sitting next to me named Harvey Matthews that a lot of your listeners now will recognize this name. And he raises his hand very politely. And this woman, the woman who was director at that point, her name was Gwen Wright. And he goes, Ms. Wright, you know, you said that it's an alleged cemetery. That's not true. I used to play in that cemetery as a child because in Montgomery County was segregated. So black kids could not go to the parks. And so the cemetery became our playground. So I know every inch of that cemetery, and I know what happened to it. But when I heard him say that, I had heard EPA lie so much. I had heard officials at USDA, Department of Commerce, you name it. I've seen all of them tell incredible lies about our conditions within the federal government. And I looked around the room, and all these people were, like, looking at each other like, oh, no, where did he come from? And I looked at her, and I said, you told me it was an alleged cemetery. Now my colleague is telling me he used to play in the cemetery. I said, where are the members of our church who were buried in that cemetery? And she looked at me, and she said, I really don't know where they're at. I said, well, then we have a crime. Then we have a crime scene, don't we? You should be talking to the police and not trying to get me to falsify information on these documents. And that is really how this whole thing started. It wasn't that I was so enthusiastic about fighting for a black cemetery. I just can't stand liars. I cannot stand to be around liars, and I can't stand to be around people who want to treat black people as though we're fools. And that really just, it infuriated me that for the last 70 years, these people had taken the community that my husband and I had agreed to provide some leadership in terms of the Macedonia family, that they had taken them, you know, that they had mistreated them, that they had abused them, that they had treated them as though they were less than human beings. And for the first time, they came in contact with someone who could talk back to them, and they folded like cards. And I was amazed, quite frankly. And so then I mentioned that I wanted to bring in a very esteemed archaeologist named Dr. Michael Blakey, who many people will recognize because he was the director of science for the New York Burial Ground Project, and I asked to bring him in to do the archaeological work. And they said, oh, no, we have our own people. And I said, well, that just simply will not do. I want the best, and I want Dr. Michael Blakey. And they basically said, okay, I think this meeting is over. You know, we'll call you in a couple of weeks, and we'll try to reschedule. And that was how the first meeting ended. And so it had, to me, less to do with cemeteries as it did with the fact that I understood from the very beginning that this was a struggle for land. I had been around the USDA struggle. I had been around you, Lawrence. I understood that the land that they were talking about was what they were calling the alleged cemetery was some of the most expensive real estate on the planet Earth. I understood. I mean, you know, it didn't take a long time for me to figure out these guys are not fighting over, you know, some back alley somewhere. They're fighting about land in downtown Bethesda, Maryland, and that they wanted me to sign off on paper so that their developer friends and their political friends could make a killing on land that contained the bodies of enslaved Africans, women and children. That's what they wanted me to do. And quite frankly, I was insulted and I was angry that they would even ask, you know, the first lady of a church, the church, to even participate in our own oppression. So once I understood exactly what these people were up to, that this was going to be a bit, they were trying to initiate a big land grab And the land that we're talking about, where the cemetery is located, is worth approximately $100 million. I just want people to know the figures that we're dealing with here.
Wow.
That, you know, our ancestors are buried in some of the most expensive soil on the planet. And their goal has been for the last 8 years that we've engaged in a struggle to do everything in their power to try to sidestep us, to try to compromise our integrity, to try to lie to us in such a way that we think we're getting something. I mean, they've pulled out all the stops, but the reality is that this is about land. And all the cemetery struggles, almost all the cemetery struggles, whether they're in Tampa, whether they're in Atlanta, whether they're in Baltimore, these are struggles for land. And even though, you know, we want to sort of the picture is of the cemetery itself, but why are they struggling for cemetery? Once the developers are able to steal the land from the community, they basically, you know, tear down all the tombstones, they disinter the people, and then they put up high-rises, or they put up an apartment building or some kind of shopping center. This is a struggle about land. And so the Black community has to be very clear about that.
Wow. That, thank you so very much with the clarity. The one thing that while you were going through this struggle, I know that you have contacted some congressional offices, and I think there's a quote by someone who said something about why do you care? Kind of give me an idea as to in this struggle, while you are struggling to try to get justice, I want mm-hmm. you to tell me first. Tell me, Marcia, tell me what happened to the person that owned, just quickly, who owned that land, and where is he today?
Well, the land is, which part, which land? I mean, the land is divided into three parts. But one of the things I wanted to talk about in terms of Brother Harvey is that the
yes.
land that his family owned is now owned by Amazon. And they, as quiet as it's kept, because they don't like to advertise this, Bethesda, Maryland was a hotbed of KKK activity in the 1950s, early 60s. And the KKK used to march up and down the main road, River Road. As Harvey Matthews will tell you, they were police officers in the daytime, and they brought out their white sheets at night. So they would march up and down River Road three or four times, targeting Black families. His family was targeted, and they wanted his land, which is now where, if you go to Whole Foods, that's the Harvey Matthews homestead. And his father kept refusing to put his ex on a paper to give his home away. And then one day the KKK came after they became frustrated with him, pulled him out of the house, pulled his grandfather out of the house, and nearly beat them both to death. But that still wasn't enough for Brother Harvey Matthews and his grandfather to turn the house over, because Black people had worked on the land. They understood the value of the land, and they knew that it's often the land that makes the difference between whether they're going to starve or whether they're going to be able to feed their families. And so they were very in tune with the intergenerational concepts of land, that you get a piece of land, you bequeath that land to your children, and the land appreciates. It's the only thing, quite frankly, that really appreciates in this society. And if you don't have land, then you're always subject to being an employee of someone who owns land. So land is very important. Our forefathers understood the importance of land, and they were not going to be driven off of the land, not even under the terror of the KKK. But what happened to Brother Harvey's family is very interesting, Because on one of those visits, the KKK didn't just beat him to death, almost to death in front of the family. They actually put him in back of the truck, and they took him to an undisclosed location. They kidnapped him, and they kept him there for a couple of days. And that's where, you know, eventually he did assign his ex to the paper. But the KKK told him, you know, we'll let you, now since we own the land, we'll let you stay there as long as you want to. But, of course, it's the KKK. They don't tell the truth. So the following week, they came and they forced the family to leave. And they became refugees, and they had to find members to live with. So these are some of the stories that we've now gathered around this incredible community on River Road. Another story is on the River Road area, the two stories, and then we'll go back to the other question you asked me, is that this is an area where there's a lot of stone quarries, and there are a lot of, you know, quarries in this area, and there's some particular stones that come out of this area. And the White House found out around the 1930s about this incredible black community where there were all these stonemasons. And so every week they would send a horse and buggy or whatever to the community. As it turns out, it's this community that we live in that the bodies are now being desecrated that actually built the bunkers under the White House. They built the bunker under the White House. It is
wow.
Their bodies that the developers are digging up, chopping into little pieces, and sending to a landfill. I mean, it's an amazing story. And then also, because we're about maybe 20, 30 miles from Washington, D.C., the women, when they were about to give birth, they would always try to leave in enough time so they could get the Freedmen's Hospital that we call now Howard University Hospital, so that they could have their children at the hospital. As it turns out, a lot of the women didn't make it, and some of the babies didn't make it because life happens. And so this is the community that organized a fund drive that raised enough money so that they could build a colored wing into Suburban Hospital, which is not too far from here. Most people don't even know the history of how this small little wing of a hospital was built. And as it turns out, Harvey Matthews, whose father, you know, was the victim of KKK and who played in the black cemetery, he was the first baby to be born in the colored wing of Suburban Hospital. So this is an amazing community with an amazing history. And Montgomery County made the decision that they were going to erase every line of their history, not just the cemetery, but even the history of how they built schools and how they had midwifery and businesses. All of that had to be destroyed on the altar of white supremacy. And so we've written 3 books now about this community, and we're about to give birth now to a 4th book about this community. But it's an amazing community. And the Africans who were brought here, the first generation of Africans who were brought here, they suffered a great deal. Obviously, they were forced into tobacco production. And they were tortured, and they were murdered, and their bodies were thrown in this place we call Moses Cemetery. And then in 1807, there was a confluence between the ending of what they call the transatlantic slave trade that we just call European barbarism, because that's really what this trade was about. It was just a human trafficking trade. And at the same time, the soils, tobacco is very hard on the soil. And so the soils stopped yielding tobacco. And so you have this confluence where, you know, they're not getting, the planters are no longer able to get the quantity of Africa, the kidnapped people coming from Africa. And at the same time, the soils are depleting. So they had to find a new industry so that they could continue to increase their wealth. and they decided that they were going to breed young children, young girls in particular. And so they started, so this is a part of the sexual exploitation area as well, where they started literally breeding little teeny girls, because there was a theory that the earlier girls became sexually active, the quicker the menses would start. And so now we're at the point of looking at research where they were literally renting out little five-year-old girls on the weekends as party favors. And it's just a horrific story of how they use the bodies of these little girls. They believed that every little girl they bought should be able to produce between 13 and 15 children. So for them, this was a business model. The problem was that these little girls died in large numbers. 60% of these little girls would die, would bleed out during childbirth. And their bodies would be thrown in a cemetery called Moses Cemetery.
Wow.
In terms of the children, there was a huge mortality rate with children. 60% of all the children, and the majority of people, children who survived the traffic from Africa to the West, are children. They're children. And 60%, and we don't usually think about, quote-unquote, the slave trade as a children's trade, but we need to begin to think about this as a children's trade. And 60% of these children would die before they reached the age of 10. So this was mass murder. This was mass murder on a scale that the world has never seen before. And when those children would die, their bodies would be thrown in a cemetery or a dumping ground that we now call Moses Cemetery.
Wow. Well, thank you. Marcia, I thank you for the clarity. And I think our listening public has really gotten a real good education about what is really going on. But I also want you to explain to us, based on some of the conversations and that I've been able to listen to during you all's sessions in the evening and planning sessions, where are our leaders? You're going through this struggle. Kind of tell us about, because we're having the same problem with our black leadership and other congressional leadership. Can you describe to us what is happening on some of the comments that have been made and some of the lack of support that you have not been able to get from our black leadership?
Yeah. Well, it's very similar to when we were all fighting for the No Fear Act. We ran into the same problem, didn't we, with black leadership or lack thereof. So the first comment that you made before you asked me this question was a comment that I received from David Crone, who is running for U.S. Senate. He's now a congressman in Maryland. And I met him at a Black History program, and I was trying to give him a leaflet about the Moses Cemetery. And he looked at it, and he said, nobody cares about this cemetery. You know, and when he first said it, I thought, no, I couldn't have heard that. And I spoke to my sister-in-law who was with me, and I went back to him and I said, excuse me, what did you just say to me? And he said, nobody cares about that little cemetery. Because for white people, black people are not really human. I mean, it's hard for us to get to that point where we understand that there are people who look at us as being subhuman. You know, we don't value our ancestors the way, you know, white people value their family lines and their lineage. That's, you know, we're just sort of born, and then we just sort of, you know, muddle around, I suppose, and then we make ourselves useful to white people while we're alive, and then when we're dead, they dig us up and and sent us to landfills, and then they put a highway on top of us. For them, that's the natural course of events, that we don't have the same kind of, we don't acknowledge where we came from. We don't acknowledge it, the sacrifice that our moms and dads and our grandparents made for us. For us, we put them in the ground and we just forget about them. You know, they mean nothing. So that's their concept of us. They're very much like a dog or any other kind of animal. We don't look back once we bury something. We just bury it and keep going. So that was what he was saying to me. Who cares about Harriet Tubman? Who cares about your grandmother? Whatever. And so we started a petition, and I would ask all of your listeners to please go to our petition. And all you have to do is just write in David Trone, who cares about that little cemetery, and a petition will come up. And we're asking everyone to sign it. I think we're at about 400 right now, 400 signatures right now. So we should be at around 500 next week. And interestingly enough, his office called. I was expecting it when they found out about the petition. And as you know, David Trone is like one of the richest men in this country. He's a billionaire, made his fortune off of selling liquor, primarily, I assume, in the black community. And now he's running for the U.S. Senate. And so, he's got all the money in the world, and now he wants power by being a U.S. senator. And if you look at his commercials, if you're in the Washington, D.C. area, his commercials are on TV every 2 minutes, and he's got all these black politicians singing his praise. But he's a billionaire, so he's able to write a lot of checks. So they called us and said, we want you to come in to talk to us. We understand you got a petition. And I said, we'll talk, but we'll only talk to Mr. Trone. Oh, no, we want you to come in and talk to some black person in their office. And I said, no, we will talk to Mr. Trone, but we're not talking to anyone at all. I mean, that's just, it's ridiculous. I mean, why are we going in and talking to a mouthpiece when we can talk to the person who offended us? And so that's where we left that at this point. But we have not found very many politicians that, are prepared to really speak out against the desecration of these burial grounds. And that is because we are dealing with the issue of land. We're dealing with the fundamentals of capitalism, and that is that land is the most important and valuable asset in a capitalist society. And a lot of the developers, provide a great deal of money to politicians for their campaigns. And so to talk about or against desecration is to basically, cut off your future as a politician. So very few politicians will come out. In fact, 2 weeks ago, we sent letters to Congressman Jamie Raskin of the January 6th, hearing fame, asking him just to denounce desecration, to denounce, our cemetery was flooded 3 weeks ago by the developer in collusion with Montgomery County. So our cemetery right now is underwater. And so we asked Congressman Raskin to denounce the flooding, the intentional flooding of a cemetery, a black cemetery. He wouldn't do it. He would not denounce the flooding of a black cemetery. And this is the same man that when he spoke at the NAACP 6 months ago received three standing ovations. Three standing ovations.
Wow. You're kidding. Wow.
Well, our community is just, we're so engaged in all the hype and what we see on television. And yet these politicians are, quite frankly, just making fools of us. So one of the primary goals of BACC is to educate the community so that we stop supporting politicians who do not support our community and who just come in and use us and then throw us away when we become an inconvenience.
Thank you so very much. Marcia, tell me something. We hear a lot about reparations, and I want to know how does reparation feed into this? And we also hear a lot from the politicians, and you can't turn on TV without hearing the word equity. And they throw this word around like it is supposed to mean something to them, and we're finding out from what's going on at USDA, the sexual abuse, the discrimination against employees, and what's going on with farmers in this day and time. We hear all these politicians talking about reparations. Then you have another group around the country who are talking about reparations. Is there a connection here at all?
Yeah. I mean, obviously Africans in this country are one of the few groups that have suffered a little bit the way we've suffered, that have not received reparations. I mean, the Japanese have received, I mean, a number of groups have received reparations for, you know, for being violated and murdered and raped. And I mean, we are all the survivors of genocide. We're the survivors of genocide. And they've tried to sort of keep that kind of consciousness out of our minds. That we survived genocide. And so, you know, if I go back to the Harvey Matthews story again, this is a good example of why we deserve. His family had suffered the barbaric, you know, system of white supremacy, which they like to call slavery. And then on top of it, they build a big farm, and they're sort of trying to rebuild their lives. And then the Europeans see the work that they're doing and say, you know, we want all of this land. We want everything, and we're not going to pay for it. You leave with your life. That's your payment, is that we're not going to kill you. And that's basically the only thing that Harvey Matthews' family leaves with. It's just their lives. They have to start all over again. No intergenerational wealth, even though that plot of land that belonged to Harvey Matthews' family is now worth about $30 million. And Harvey Matthews has had to do, lawn work and other kinds of jobs in order to put food on the table when his family had already created the basis of their wealth when they bought the land on River Road.
Wow.
So now you've got two or three generations and have never recovered from what the Ku Klux Klan did in the 19th. We must have reparations for all of the Africans who were murdered. We must have reparations for all the black girls who suffered rape, which became, you know, sort of the traumatic moment of their lives when everything stopped for them and their lives were totally stolen. You know, we must have reparations for all the land that was stolen from us, from all of the. So for me, there is no difference between the cemetery struggle here in Bethesda and the fight for reparations. In fact, we have our own reparations document. And we've got over, I think, about 50 organizations have signed on to it now. We're very serious about reparations, because if you're serious about liberation, you have to be serious about reparations. And so it's one of the basic core values that we have in our group, is that we are fighting to repair and, in fact, to liberate black people from economic from being a constant economic underclass, because the money is there. It's just that the money has been stolen from us, and we're demanding that they return the money and the land, because our major struggle around what is called the cemetery land is that we're not asking for a plaque. We're not asking for a bench. We're not asking for pretty sidewalks. We want the land. We're struggling for the land. And that land is to be used to tell the story of what happened to black people in this country and what happened to the Africans who came here for the first generation, because our history does not start in the United States. Our history starts in Africa. So almost all of our literature starts in Africa, and then we talk about what happened when we came over the ocean. So we've had the same issues along with you, with black politicians.
Okay.
And so we just continue to struggle, and we continue to tell the truth, because that's the most important thing we can do, is always tell the truth.
Tell the truth.
Tell
yes.
the truth, because the Bible says truth crushed to the ground will rise. And that's been our experience, is that if we have the courage to tell the truth, then even if it's not received immediately, 5-10 years down the road, people will say, isn't that what they said 10 years ago? So it's important that you really plug into the truth, and that you don't allow people to cheat you out of just being very clear about your history and the struggle that you're engaged in.
Marcia,
and Lawrence, there is someone on the line that has their
yes.
line open.
See if C.J. Johnson is on to possibly ask a question of Dr. Adebayo. Let's go to the question. And Marcia, I want to thank you. I know I'm holding you much longer than we had planned, but please bear with us for a little while longer, because I think we may have some people on the line that may want to ask you some questions as well. I appreciate
sure.
it. Thank you.
Thank you.
615, would you like to speak? Hello? Yes. Would you speak? Do you have a question?
What about number 240, area code? Is that person still on the line?
I have 240731. Marcia, is that you?
That's Marcia. I'm talking about C.J. Johnson on 240-640-0089.
No, I do not
okay.
have him on the line.
Okay.
I have one.
Who else do we have?
Yes. Let me ask someone else. 608, do you have a question? I believe that's Cause.
Hey, Marcel.
Hey, Cuz.
I've been listening here and on and off while I've been baking, and I mean, my heart is broken hearing this. I grew up in Montgomery County. I'm guessing this is Montgomery County, Maryland.
Yes.
That you guys are. Yeah, I lived there until I was like 14 years old. So I was wondering, where is the cemetery located in Maryland, or was located?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cemetery is downtown Bethesda. So if you take River Road going towards Potomac,
okay.
it's about maybe 15 minutes from the D.C. line, from the D.C. border.
Wow.
You'll see Whole Foods, if you're familiar with this area, Whole Foods, McDonald's. That's all the area of the cemetery. But the cemetery itself is located, interestingly enough, because it's a children's cemetery, but it's located right next to McDonald's on River Road.
Oh, my
Road.
Gosh.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I was in Silver Spring, so it wasn't right there. I appreciate your advocacy on this, and I look forward to signing the petition.
Oh,
and
thank you so much.
Absolutely. I hope that Marcel will help me find the link, and then I can get it shared. And I just appreciate everything that you've done, and this has been an eye-opening podcast, and thank you so much for coming on and just being an advocate for those. They're gone, and their story needs to be told, and shame on the United States. So many things that we talk about on this podcast, shame on our country for the crimes against humanity that are committed in so many different areas and aspects of our lives. And
right. Amen. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Marcel. Thank you, Marcia. I'll let you guys finish up, and I'll put myself back on mute.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you. What about 202? Hold on. What about 202-630, Gary Johnson, Marcel?
No, I don't have. I have a 402. 402, would you like?
Okay.
Yes, I would.
Okay, please.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
yes, can
I
can. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I just called the number because I have a different issue. I sometimes call this 917 a guardianship issue, but it is so heartrending to hear this lady's issue. My issue is a husband who's being overdrugged and isolated in a nursing home. But I feel there's a lot of similarities in the way they treat the way they treat people. And I don't mean just black people or white people, the way certain higher-ups treat everyone. And I'm very concerned. My husband has developed tremendous shaking and Parkinson's from the overdrugging. And I was just calling, and I know that's not the subject you're on, if anyone had any advice about that.
Marcel?
No, this is still the other lady, or should I press one?
Okay. Marcel, do we have any others that are interested in calling in? I think Mr. Johnson you probably get him on let me see what we got here. 240. That was C.J. Johnson. And we also have a Gary Johnson on 301-814. Do you see him, Marcel? I don't know where she went. Hello? Hello? Marcel? Marcel? I may have to call back in.
I think you must have been over.
Hello? Hello?
I'm sorry. For some reason, we were knocked off the line. I just got us back up. Marcia, are you still here?
Oh, no, I'm still here, although I have another